One does wonder what this economic week is going to bring, doesn't one? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 9th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today and we begin this week in this economy with a look at the calendar. The big item is going to be Thursday, the December Consumer Price Index, wither inflation as the Fed keeps its foot on the economic brake. The end of the week also brings a new corporate earnings season. On Friday, we're going to hear from a gaggle of big banks, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo among them. FactSet is guessing fourth quarter profits for S&P 500 companies overall are going to be down more than 4% from a year ago, the worst corporate report since early on in the pandemic. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our lead story today.
So far, predictions aren't great for corporate earnings in the fourth quarter when the economy was slowing and layoffs were spreading in tech and finance. Equity analyst Ken Leon at CFRA Research sees the big banks' earnings as a harbinger of what's to come.
A weaker fourth quarter in 22 versus 21, lots of uncertainty for 2023.
He says mortgage finance, investment banking, M&As, and IPOs have all slumped as markets have faltered and borrowing costs have increased. But there's also an upside to higher interest rates for banks, says Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics.
The interest rates on their deposits, they're rising very slowly, but the interest rate they charge on their loans are up. So they are doing pretty well on that so-called net interest margin. That's their profit margin, and it's pretty good.
But Zandi doesn't think that'll last, which might be welcome news for savers.
I do think banks will need to pay their depositors more to hold on to deposits. They are starting to lose deposits.
And what happens to banks' balance sheets in 2023 will tell us a lot about recession risk, says Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics.
Banks are canaries in the economic coal mine.
Quincy Crosby, chief global strategist at LPL Financial, puts it this way.
Whatever happens in the economy is going to manifest itself in the banks.
She'll be watching for any rise in defaults on mortgages, car loans, and credit cards, and how much banks have to put aside to cover those losses.
That will give us an indication of how Americans are dealing with paying back debt.
Crosby says banks reporting on credit card use has already told us something important.
Lower wage earners have been using their cards more and more for necessities than just discretionary items.
A sign higher prices and dwindling savings are pushing those consumers a little closer to the edge. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, everything was fine, just fine. Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. There's a concept known as right of repair that's been a thing for a while now. You own something, basically you should have the right to repair it. And that is not, in this digital economy, always been a thing that companies that make things are wild about. Take, just for instance, farm equipment. For years, farm and consumer advocacy groups have accused John Deere, maker of tractors and balers and all kinds of very expensive farm equipment, of not letting farmers get their hands on the diagnostic tools that would let them fix that very expensive farm equipment that they have bought. This weekend, though, Deere signed a memorandum of understanding with the American Farm Bureau Federation, saying farmers will now be allowed to buy the tools and manuals they need to make their own repairs. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on that.
When Terry Griffin was a young adult in the 80s and 90s, he helped drive the tractor to plant crops on his family's farm in Arkansas. And he says he wasn't good at it.
My attention span is fairly short, and that is not a good thing in order to be the person who's trying to make straight rows of putting seed in the ground.
Griffin is now an agricultural economist at Kansas State University. He says today's tractors have GPS and other technology that make it easier to plant in straight lines, but there's a drawback.
It made it simpler to operate, but more complex to repair.
John Deere products account for more than 40% of market share for tractors and other agricultural machinery in the U.S. This memorandum of understanding with the company means farmers won't have to haul that machinery in need of repairs to John Deere authorized mechanics who might be hours away. Sam Kiefer is with the American Farm Bureau Federation.
If there is an error code, they can make the fix, even if it's temporary, just to finish the job.
Or farmers can take it to a local independent mechanic. David Gilmore, John Deere's senior vice president of sales and marketing, said at a press conference this weekend that the company knows its machines are a big investment for farmers.
And the opportunity for them to maximize the uptime of that equipment and minimize downtime is an important area of focus for our organization and for the industry.
But it's not clear how much John Deere will charge farmers for access to diagnostic tools and parts.
This absolutely could be a significant revenue stream for John Deere.
Kyle Weens is the CEO of iFixit, an online repair guide, and one of the leaders of the Right to Repair movement. He says this agreement is a step in the right direction, but
the concern is that there's no enforcement mechanism in this memorandum. It's just an agreement between Farm Bureau and John Deere.
In fact, the Farm Bureau agreed to refrain from supporting Right to Repair legislation at the state or federal level as part of this memorandum. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
We had a story last week about a town in Louisiana that's been raising most of its historic buildings, literally raising them higher because of the rising seas and flooding that are coming with climate change. Millions of buildings in coastal areas and river areas around the country are going to need to be handled like this. And that is a business opportunity for a growing industry of house lifters. Marketplace's Amy Scott, the host of our climate podcast, How We Survive, set about finding out how one goes about lifting a house.
On a dead-end street in Slidell, Louisiana, near New Orleans, a little house is about to get a big lift from ground level to more than 8 feet up. This was back in July. Half a dozen workers, drenched in sweat and covered in mud, have tunneled under the house, set up piles of wood blocks or cribbing, picture a giant game of Jenga, along with 38 hydraulic jacks. The men crawl in and out, making small adjustments, while a supervisor eyes dozens of gauges.
He's adjusting all the pressures on each hydraulic cylinder individually, so that way when we lift the house, it guarantees it lifts at a constant rate.
Jason Soto is head of marketing at Davy Shoring. The company specializes in elevating houses in the flood-prone Gulf Coast region. And lately, it's been busy.
We have 18 in the city of Slidell alone and probably about 25 in the surrounding areas as well.
Slidell is on Lake Pontchartrain and can flood when storms push water from the Gulf into the lake and surrounding bayous.
When the hurricanes come, we're on the north side of the lake. The winds push everything to us first, so we get a massive storm surge every single time.
The house will be lifted in stages, about 8 inches at a time. After each lift,
they will build this crib pile up to where they can put the jack up higher, and then they will repeat the process. It takes about 2 hours, anywhere from an hour to 2 hours between each lift, depending on the size of the house.
While we wait for the first lift, the house's owner pulls up in her car to watch the progress. Tracy Perry, a hairdresser, bought the house in 2006 for just under $98,000 after it had been damaged by Hurricane Katrina. Then, 6 years later,
Isaac came in over the baseboards just long enough to get it nice and
wet,
moist, and then it rolled out.
When the house goes up, she's looking forward to her flood insurance going down. She pays about $2,000 a year.
And I have it's a 1,000-square-foot house. It's tiny.
Yeah.
Lifting this tiny house will cost more than $100,000. A grant from FEMA will cover 90%, leaving just over $10,000 out of pocket. But long term,
I think the value, I mean, being on this dead end, hello, she'll shine like a star.
You might think the hoisting would be rough on a house, but not if it goes well. Perry took her pictures off the wall, but left everything else pretty much as is. She'll check into a nearby hotel for a couple nights.
I'm actually looking forward to staying in the hotel. They have a hot tub and a pool, so it's like a mini vacation.
The whole process, from applying for the grant to receiving it and then getting on Davy Shoring's schedule, has taken about 4 years. And now Perry will have to wait a bit longer. While we're talking, Soto comes over with some bad news.
So it's going to be a little while.
He says there's an addition on the back that flexed when they started to lift the house.
We have to do additional tunneling under the addition. They want to put a couple more support jacks underneath the addition in the back for the lift.
In the end, Perry spent 4 nights away from the house. But when I called her up recently, she was happy with the result.
I love it. I just tell everybody in the neighborhood, I'm the queen. I'll let them know if something's coming.
From her perch above her neighbors, she'll be able to see an incoming storm first. She has discovered one downside of elevated living, though. In the fall, she broke her ankle and had to negotiate the 18 steps to her front door. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We literally had maybe like $600 and went there.
When you gotta, you gotta, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 112 points this Monday, 0.3%, 33,000 to 517. The NASDAQ up 66 points, about 0.6%, 10,635. The S&P 500 down 2. Call that flat, really, 38 and 92 there. Just heard from Amy Scott about what it takes to raise a house to be safe from rising sea levels. So look at some related stocks, why don't we? Terex Corporation, which makes cranes and other equipment. Lifted. Get it? Lifted. Talking about lifting houses. 1.3%. Caterpillar pulled back 0.9%. Please tell me you're laughing with me. You might have heard, actually you probably did hear on this program, that Bed Bath & Beyond has been looking at bankruptcy after a turbulent year. Well, today the home goods retailer had a meme-ish rebound. Shares up 23.6%. Guaranteed not the last of this story. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You might have heard last week that the Federal Trade Commission has proposed a near total ban on non-compete clauses, agreements between companies and employees designed to prevent those workers from taking trade secrets over to the competition, but which can in practice keep those workers from looking for better opportunities and higher pay. Most of the time, though, when you think non-compete, you probably think white-collar workers, right? Executives, maybe software developers, too. But some of the lowest paid workers in this economy are bound by those agreements as well. Think fast food workers and custodial staff. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more on what a ban on non-competes might mean for them.
Nearly a third of private sector businesses that responded to a survey from the Economic Policy Institute require all of their employees to sign non-competes, including a quarter of respondents that mostly employ high school graduates.
So it just is this surprisingly prevalent thing, even among workers who are making very low wages.
Heidi Scherholtz with the EPI says non-competes neutralize the best tool those workers have for securing higher pay, their ability to shop around.
It's in the name, right? And when employers aren't competing with each other, then workers and consumers lose out.
In sectors like fast food and retail, these agreements do often function as cheap retention tools, says Andy Challenger with the staffing firm Challenger, Gray and Christmas.
From the employer's perspective, they would like to potentially reduce turnover.
But non-competes hardly ever go to court, says economist Evan Starr at the University of Maryland.
They tend to be enforced informally in exit interviews, in threatening letters to workers.
A few states, including California, have stripped non-competes of any legal teeth. Others have banned them for lower-paying positions. But Starr says workers don't always know that. Sometimes just the threat of a lawsuit is enough.
Low-wage workers generally don't have the wherewithal to finance litigation, even for a frivolous non-compete agreement.
If the FTC's proposed ban goes through, Starr says those workers will have a lot more leverage. As for their employers, he says there are alternatives, like non-disclosure agreements, that protect sensitive information without limiting workers' mobility. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
If you're in a car right now, and a lot of you probably are, first of all, eyes on the road. But if you can, safely, take a look at the cars around you. You probably see some Toyota logos, GM maybe, BMW or Tesla, depending on where you are. And you might also see one that looks, at a very quick first glance, kind of like KN. It actually says Kia. In a very stylized kind of way. The Korean car maker changed its logo a couple of years ago, and now thousands of people every single month are Googling KN car to find out what's going on. James Bowie is a sociologist at Northern Arizona University, where he studies logo design, and from where he recently wrote about the Kia confusion for Fast Company. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Could you help me understand, first of all, why Kia, a successful car brand, decided to change its logo in the first place?
I think, you know, 2 years ago when they brought out this new logo, I think they were maybe looking to project more of an upscale feel. And mm-hmm. they focused on this idea of mobility and movement, kind of, I think, looking to the future. And the logo was, you know, a handy way to signal that change that they were looking for.
Okay, but have they succeeded? Because as I said up in the introduction, people are confused by this thing, including me, to be completely honest with you.
I think they have succeeded. It's been 2 years. Their stock appears okay.
And also, we're talking about it, right? So that's a win.
Yeah, I think the fact that 30,000 people a month are Googling KN car because they don't seem to be able to read the logo might sound initially like a bad thing, but I think it shows that people are curious. Like, hey, what's that cool car I saw in my opinion, is better than people ignoring your product altogether.
Fair enough. So in a certain world, in the design world and in the consumer curiosity world, this has become a tad trendy. Is that a good thing?
You know, the trends in logo design seem to kind of come and go. In this case, we're talking about crossbarless A's.
Right. You jumped ahead to the next question on my list. No, that's all right. Let's explain the crossbarless A and how it applies in this context and then more widely.
Well, both the old and the new Kia logos have a crossbarless A. The new one is a little more elaborate in design and perhaps a little harder to read, but that's a trend we've seen going back to the 1960s. It was kind of a shortcut that designers can take to maybe project an image of, you know, futurism or modernism. We've seen this trend go from being 1% of A's in logos in 1970 to up to 2% in 2000 and up to 9% in the past year. And I think there is, up to a point, there's a benefit to following one of these graphic design trends.
So two things about that. Number one, it's interesting to me that there is a set of specialists in this country who track the percentage of crossbarless A's and logos, right?
I think that's me.
Okay, yes, that's you. But also, if everybody's doing a crossbarless A, is anybody doing a crossbarless A? You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Once it becomes too common, it becomes sort of like the slang word that your mother starts using. Where it's like, oh, you know, perhaps this trend has gone too far and we need to move on to the next thing.
How did it come to be, by the way, just this is a little off topic, but whatever, that you as a sociologist started studying and becoming expert in logos?
Well, it's a long story and your program is not that long, but in the 1990s, I was in graduate school, interested in the sociology of organizations and the sociology of culture. And I started noticing in the late 1990s, there were all these dot-com companies that had these swooshes for logos. And it was really prevalent at the time. And I realized, well, logos actually are an interesting intersection of these two areas that I'm interested in, organizations and culture. And I started kind of following this topic, discovered that the United States Patent and Trademark Office maintains data on the graphical makeup of logos.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, long story short, yeah.
That's quite the data set. All right, last thing, and then I'll let you go. Do you have an absolute favorite logo out there?
Wow, that's a good one. Just for entertainment purpose, I really like the logo of Yellow, the trucking company.
I'm not familiar.
It's a trucking company. They have a fairly simple word mark saying their name, Yellow, and it's inside of kind of a trapezoidal holding shape, but that shape is colored in orange. and it's just one of these kind of non sequiturs that always tickles me every time I see it.
Makes you pay attention. James Bowie, he's a sociology professor at Northern Arizona University. Professor Bowie, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai. It was fun.
As I said up at the top of the program, we got our next inflation update on Thursday morning, the December Consumer Price Index. You might remember, or you might not, I get it, that the biggest contributor to inflation in the last reading was shelter, basically rent or mortgage. It was up 7% year on year. And it also, shelter does, happens to be one of the stickiest parts of the inflation equation. Housing costs rarely go down, right? So here with the next installment of our series Adventures in Housing, one family's ongoing search for a place to live.
My name is Devontae Bradford.
My name is Cassandra Bradford.
I am a tree foreman. I cut trees down for a tree service.
And I am an associate teacher at Pace Head Start. I grew up in a small town called Oaktown, Indiana. It's really small. You blink, you could miss it.
Pretty much he's been my ride or die since we've been kids, you know. We basically grew up together.
We were high school sweethearts.
My mother moved out to Arizona I want to say the year 2012.
She really missed us and her grandkids, of course. So she was like, I think you guys will do such a great job out here. And then we just decided, you know what, we might as well give it a try. So we did. We literally had maybe like $600 and went there.
I had a little Chrysler Sebring, and we had our two babies in the back, and we were newbies when it came to driving in the mountains. And
we had to pull over quite a few times.
Everything's a lot more expensive out there, and it took quite some time to kind of get on our feet.
And then that's whenever we actually got pregnant with our third child. And it was so hard there because it was hard to get on like insurance to find a doctor. Like the waiting list went from months to months to even get on insurance. So that's when we decided just to make that move back here because it would just be easier, really.
We've been staying in our apartment here in Vincennes, Indiana for...
Since 2018.
Since 2018.
Oh, no, 19.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2019.
It's low rent and everything's affordable, but you get what you pay for, honestly.
There's just not a lot of opportunities really here.
And you got to ask yourself, you know, is this what I want to do with my... Is this where I want to raise my family? Is this where I want to live, you know, and... So I think we're going to go out west and give it another shot.
Yeah. We're thinking about moving to Goodyear, Arizona.
The moving back and forth, I think trying to find what fits us, you know, find what a state where you could find a good home, you know, and find a decent job and make a, you know, an honest, good living, you know. We're hoping this is our last move, and we're hoping that it works out for the best.
Devante and Cassandra Bradford right there, living, at least for now, in Vincennes, Indiana. You can tell us about your adventures in housing. We'd like it if you would do that for us. Marketplace.org is where you go. Final note on the way out today, Bob Iger is wasting no time in his second stint running the Walt Disney Company. CNBC has gotten his hands on an all-staff email from Iger, which says the days of being a hybrid are gone. People are going to have to be in the office 4 days a week. And I thought that was worth a mention for a couple of reasons. Number one, Disney is Disney, so it's got some industry-wide influence. Also, though, 4 days a week in person is more than most other big companies are doing. 2 to 3, really, is kind of the norm. Okay, that's it. We're done. Here, though, is, of course, your moment of economic context. Anybody remember the Ever Given, the big container ship that got stuck and blocked the Suez Canal for almost a week back in 2021? Well, today, a much smaller cargo ship lost power in the canal, disrupted traffic for a little bit. About 20 ships got held up for a couple of hours. Not a huge deal, but I thought a reminder about the fragility of global trade was in order. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.